If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, July the 2nd. Welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today here in Hoover's recording studio on the campus of Stanford University is Paul Peterson. Paul Peterson is a Hoover Institution Senior Fellow, Professor of Government, and Director of the Program in Education Policy and Governance at Harvard. He's also a Senior Editor at Education Next, a Journal of Opinion and Research. And our topic today is, not surprisingly, going to be education. So, Paul, you are a bi-coaster. You divide your time between the East Coast and the West Coast. Right now we're on the West Coast, which I think you're enjoying very much with our delightful July weather. And one thing about California in July is that it is the beginning of a new fiscal year. Unlike the federal government, which runs October to October, California's new year begins in July. And the budget the governor signed just the other day, Paul, is a $215 billion spending behemoth. And I say behemoth, Paul, because I worked for a California governor back in the 1990s, and our budgets were in the neighborhood of anywhere from about $45 to $65 billion. So the California spending has gone crazy in the past couple decades. If you look within that budget, Paul, what you'll see of the $215 billion that Gavin Newsom signed into law, 103.4 of that is devoted to education spending. That includes both local and statewide operations. That's a boost of more than $6 billion, that's billion with a B, $6 billion from last summer's budget, and a $40 billion, let me repeat that, a $40 billion increase from what lawmakers approved for California in 2014. Now, we can agree that education in California is a complicated topic to discuss. Districts in California receive a combination of local, state, and federal dollars. California, more than other states, relies on statewide tax revenues to pay for education. It's a framework that goes back to Proposition 13 in 1978, capped by local property taxes and schools turning ever-growing subsidy from Sacramento. But here's the question to start off this conversation, Paul. It's money. You talk to education experts, including some here at Stanford, and the first thing that comes out of their mouth is we need to spend more money on public schools. And there was a study done last year by some experts here at Stanford, which talked about throwing another $22 billion a year into the education kitty in California. But you look at California, Paul, and you see decidedly mixed results. For example, about 39% of students in California schools can pass the math portion of the computer-based exam known as the Smarter Balanced Assessment. In terms of language, that's obviously not good. So the question, Paul, money, the Beatles once sang, money can't buy me love. Why can't money buy success in public schools?
Well, you know, it's a hard job turning money into real value in the classroom. Mm-hmm. You've got to find the teachers who will do the job. You've got to find the students who will be engaged, and mm-hmm. you've got to find a setting in which everybody is working together.
Right.
And money doesn't buy all of those things, especially when your money is being spent to hire teachers on a sort of a fixed salary schedule.
Right.
No business does this. No business says that, well, maybe sometimes in manufacturing, you'll get some examples of this where the trade unions have forced it upon them. But mm-hmm. no, ordinarily, businesses will pay people according to how much they're contributing to the organization. And, mm-hmm. and teachers are not being paid on the basis of how much they're contributing to the learning of the students. So that's a very big fact. And the other big fact is you cannot dismiss teachers.
Right.
that are not performing. Now, there's just been a study released about Providence schools, which is truly amazing because the mayor and this superintendent in Providence invited an outside group to come in and actually sit inside the schools, which is never done. I mean, you try do that in California, you won't get inside the school door.
Right.
And the things they saw in the classroom, they saw teachers spending their time looking at their cell phones. They saw kids roaming the walls, the hallways. They saw total chaos in the classroom. The storylines were truly amazing. Now you can say maybe that's just Providence, but
right.
My guess is there's plenty of that going on in California, and it's because you as an administrator have very little control over the people who are under you. They are going to be there whether you like it or not.
Right. I have a friend who is looking at joining a business, and the business wants to hire her as basically the COO. The CEO of the company wants her to come in and be the bad cop, which means you come in and you tell people no. It's like the provost of university in that regard. You tell people no, you fire people who are not performing, you clear out the dead wood. You're a very hated person within the organization, but you make the organization run better. Since you mentioned the Providence example, if we look at California schools or other schools across America, what can a school system do in the way of bad policing, if you will? Can you drop somebody into a public school and make that person a bad cop?
Can you put a policeman and make him a bad cop inside?
Can you hire somebody to work at a public school and essentially say, Paul Peterson, I want you to be the bad cop. I want you to get rid of people who don't work here. I want you to turn this place around.
Good luck. I mean, yeah, first of all, if you say we have identified the one teacher in the building who all agree is the least effective teacher.
Right.
Is doing things as outside the boundary as having running up a big set of absenteeism isn't even when they're in the building they're not in the classroom.
Right.
Well, immediately you're in the middle of a 2-year grievance procedure.
Right.
Where the teacher will have the very best attorneys defending them. They're paid for by the teachers' union, and it's the job of the teachers' union to give every teacher, no matter what the circumstances, unless, of course, it's moral turpitude, the best possible defense. And that means you can drag this thing out for 2 years. And a principal will have to spend a very substantial share of his or her time in order to manage that situation. Yes, if you pursue to the end, you can dismiss the teacher, but very few principals want to spend their time working on this kind of a problem.
Right. So you take the underperforming teacher and you push that underperforming teacher into another school, and that teacher becomes that school's problem. Richard Reardon, who was the mayor of Los Angeles in the 1990s, had a great expression of this. He called it the dance of the lemons.
Yes.
Right.
The dance of the lemons is in New York City, the dance went all the way to the rubber room, where there were some teachers that were so bad that no school would take them. So they would then assign them to a room where you kept teachers who had to be paid but couldn't be allowed in the classroom. And that, until that broke as a major news story, there were a hundred or more teachers sitting in a rubber room playing cards.
Right. Let's talk a minute, Paul, about the pipeline for education spending, and let's focus on California for a second. There was a rather sad incident in the Sacramento City Unified School District in May, and they decided to let go of teachers and administrators. They let go of 77 teaching positions and overall 178 full-time positions. That included the district's only visual and performing arts coordinator and its only GATE, or Gifted and Talented Education, and AP, or Advanced Placement Coordinator. These are people who matter in schools. You may ask, why did Sacramento do this? And they would say, we don't have the money to fund this. But I started this podcast by pointing out how much more money is going into schools. Here's the problem. David Crane, a fellow who writes for a publication called Govern for California, he's a very serious government reform fellow, he pointed out that every dollar spent on retirement costs is a dollar taken from teacher staffing or salaries. In the case of the Sac City District, Paul, Sac City devotes about 15% of its revenues to retirement costs. That's about a 50% increase over the past 5 years. It seems to me we have a problem here. On the one hand, a state like California, as long as times are flush and the revenue is good, the state of California is going to spend more money in the direction of public schools. But as we see from these clogged pipelines, from the retirement costs, pension costs, health care costs, the money's not getting into the classroom. So tell me, sir, how do we fix this?
Well, it's very hard to fix the pension problem because, again, that's a contractual relationship that has been established between teachers and school districts and the state of California. And so that money is obligated, and attempts to pare back on that have proven unsuccessful in the courts. The courts defend the employees' right to receive whatever they were told they were going to receive, no matter whether the government has that money at hand or not. So that means then the government has to increase every year the amount of money that's put into the retirement fund, and that retirement fund is going up. But I'll tell you what, the pensions is only half the story. The other half of the story are medical costs. We know that they're going up across the board in all parts of our society.
Right.
Well, in education, the teacher unions have negotiated in many states, including California, very fine contracts for their employees so that the employee pays nothing, no copay, no deductions, simply they get whatever medical services they need. And so that tends to lead to overutilization of medical services. That means that that portion of the budget that is going to go for those specific benefits is constantly climbing at a very steep rate. So that pushes back on the salaries that you can offer. Now, the teachers don't value those benefits nearly as much as they cost the district, and they want their compensation. They want the compensation to feed their family.
Right.
And that, so they're demanding more salaries as well. So all of these things together pushes up the budget at a horrendous rate without really translating into actual benefits for students.
Right. So the question is, how do we address this problem then?
Well, if you have a legislature that is strongly influenced by the California Teachers Association, and there's hardly, I don't think there's an organization as powerful in the state of California as the California Teachers Association.
Why do you say that?
Well, because they have boots on the ground in every school district.
Yes.
In every congressional district, in every legislative district.
Yes.
These are educated people. They're not just sort of people who may or may not take an interest in politics. These are people who are engaged in political life or at least aware of what's going on. So you're talking about a middle class group in the population that's got the kind of political organization that is ordinarily thought to be associated with the blue-collar community.
Right.
So that makes this an extremely effective organization. And they also can write. They can go on television. They can go on the radio. They can go on your podcast. You know, teachers are a very effective lobby group. And, of course, they have a leadership now that has seen how effective their clientele can be, and you have to give them credit. I mean, you can hardly blame the union for doing the best with its resources, and you have to compliment the California Teachers Association.
Right. So let us praise the California Teachers Association of being good at what it does, which is seize and leverage power. And I think to the non-Californian, they have to understand the following. That first of all, you're absolutely right. They have, in many regards, an emotional stranglehold on the California electorate. If I'm running an initiative campaign, Paul, I want to trot out a teacher or a policeman or a firefighter, because these are the people who wear the white hats in society, the average voter. So if there's already an emotional appeal, a teacher. What can we do for teachers? Twice in the last decade, Jerry Brown, when he was governor of California, went to the voters and asked for a tax increase, and he did it in the name of education. So there's a strong emotional appeal there, number one. Number two, they can monetize because of union dues. They just have a replenishing stream. So in each election cycle, they have a lot of money they can throw at candidates. They spend their money wisely. They advertise smartly. They endorse early. They endorse often, which is smart. And then thirdly, they fight to the death. Back in 2005, Arnold Schwarzenegger held a special election of a whole variety of reform topics, one of which was teacher tenure. And CTA looked at that and thought, boy, this is just This is a dagger to the heart. So what do? They took all their money and they took out another mortgage on their headquarters in Oakland, and they put that all into campaign coffers, and they went out and they attacked Arnold Schwarzenegger night and day, and they beat him into the ground. So the non-California has to appreciate that CTA is just a very, very strong operation that's not going away anytime soon.
You know, one of the things that makes California special is that the state funding apparatus is extremely important in education because of Proposition 14, which limits the local property tax. And so local school districts in California are 90% funded by the state, which is very different from other parts of the country. If you take the United States as a whole, about 44% comes from the local district, 44% from the state, and 10% from the federal government. So it's about 50-50 sharing between the state and the school district's own property tax base. But in California, it's 90% coming from the state. Well, one of the things we know about people is they think that money that comes from the state is free.
Yes.
Their local property taxes, they're quite well aware of. They don't want to spend any more of their local money because that's their money. They
right.
understand that's their money. Mm-hmm. They think the money that's coming from the California bank
right.
is somehow got there without anybody having to pay into the bank.
Right.
I can never figure out why people think that way, but they tend to think that money coming from on high is free.
Now, I point out the unions in California are not infallible. There was a vote held early in June, in Los Angeles, Paul, and its issue was a parcel tax increase on Angelenos. And the purpose of that was to go to the Los Angeles Unified School District, which is running a gigantic deficit. The unions made a bad political calculation here in that they, for some reason, I don't quite understand, this is basic campaign logic in California, they chose a light turnout election to try to pass a tax increase. But I suspect they felt a little cocky because they had a very highly publicized strike that they prevailed in not too long ago. And so they thought, we can turn around and go to the polls, and in the name of education, we can get this tax increased. And they got spanked by voters. They didn't even get 50% of the vote. And this is a parcel tax in California, which means that you need two-thirds approval from the voters. So a bad calculation. So while Jerry Brown did prevail on tax increases, this one in Los Angeles was defeated. But let me shift topics here.
Yeah, that's a good example of how people will not want it's really hard to pass a tax referendum.
Right.
Lately, Miami did it. And the superintendent in Miami came to Harvard and was talking to my students and explained the way he did it was he showed that the Miami school system was better than any other school system in a big city in both the country and in the state of Florida.
Right.
And he celebrated the quality of the schools, and he had every right to do so. And he managed to get a tax increase through. But Los Angeles couldn't do that.
And I want to talk more about Miami in a minute, but let me ask you a question about a gentleman who's running for president right now, and that is William Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City. Mr. de Blasio had a bad week last week under the topic of education. Are you familiar with what I'm about to say? So for the listener, here's what happened. Mr. de Blasio had an idea. He wanted to eliminate the entrance exam that dictates admission into Stuyvesant High School and New York City's other top public high schools. 2 days later, it died in the legislature in Albany. Now, part of the reason, Paul, is that Albany lawmakers don't much like Mayor de Blasio. Governor Cuomo doesn't like Mayor de Blasio, so Governor Cuomo is not going to go to the mattress and fight for the mayor. Also, lawmakers consider this topic taboo. They don't want any part of it. But there is an underlying issue here in that if you look in the last year, 895 seats available for these very selective schools in New York City, Paul, only 7 black students receive offers to Stuyvesant High School. So there's a problem here.
Well, you know, the selective schools in New York City are very few in number.
Yes.
And you have to be at the absolute top end. Remember, there's 1 million students in the New York City school system.
Right.
It's the biggest school system in the country. And there's only a few seats. I think you just said 722 seats.
895 overall.
Less than 1,000 seats.
Yes.
So you got to be in the top 1% or less than 0.1% to get in. Now, Al Shanker, who later becomes the head of the
ATF,
the American Federation of Teachers and the Union Federation of Teachers, actually did go to Bedford-Stuyvesant. He did manage to get in. He was a poor boy from Brooklyn who made it in there. But not many, but he was a truly brilliant man, as he proves later on in life, and succeeds in many ways. So he makes it into Bedford-Stuyvesant, but you know it's incredibly competitive.
Right.
So you know, there's lots and lots. The composition of that school is largely Asian, or increasingly so. I think it's now a majority Asian, even though they're a fairly small percentage of the population. And the Asian community is Asian families commit themselves to education in the way very few other families do. So they are capturing, just like they're getting into Berkeley, they are getting into Bedford-Stuyvesant. So is this a problem? I'd say what the problem is there should be more specialized schools for able students in New York City. The real problem in New York City is there are not enough Bedford-Stuyvesants. We should have a lot of schools where if you can demonstrate that you are a top performer, you can get a really top education in high school. Mm-hmm. And if they would broaden out that opportunity, there would be many more African-American students. There would be many more Hispanic-American students who would be able to get a high-quality high school education. It's a serious problem, but the solution is exactly the opposite of what people are talking about.
All right, a very simple and naive question. Why do Asian students do well in the entrance exam in New York City and African-American students do not?
Well, it's probably rooted in the family. Mm-hmm. I mean, the culture of the Asian community is such that Asian performance on all tests that we ever, wherever we look, we see that the performance of Asian students has been on the rise right. for the last 30 years, 40 years. Right. It used to be that Asians trailed whites on average across the country. They're now a giant step ahead of the white average in the United States, mm-hmm. which, of course, is higher than the Hispanic average and the African-American average. So it's not – when you talk about how Asians are doing well in education in the United States, it applies to not just the African-American community. It's across the board.
Right.
So this is a problem that we face at Harvard University. Harvard University would like to have a diverse clientele. unfortunately, having a diverse clientele means you have to have an admissions policy that puts you at risk when somebody files a lawsuit against you saying you should give equal opportunity to all applicants.
I think you and I could do an entirely separate podcast, and it might get you fired in the process, but a separate podcast about the admissions policy at Harvard, which I have read with great fascination. I have a godson who went through the Ivy process 2 years ago, so I learned a lot about it and the idea of readings and sending along recommendations and striking down certain applicants because they don't seem, quote-unquote, entertaining enough or interesting enough. In other words, they're just not going to add that much joie de vivre to the campus. They're grinders. It's sad, but I look at this New York City story and it reminds me of the argument for years about the SATs and the idea that the SATs are, quote, culturally biased.
Well, now the SAT is proposing a change where mm-hmm. they are going to give students who are said to be disadvantaged because they come from homes that are of low income,
right.
They're going to give them extra points. So your SAT score will no longer be based on how well you do on an examination. Mm-hmm. It will be based on how well you do on an examination plus some background characteristics over which you have no control.
Right.
Now, it might be that colleges and universities may want to take that into account in their admissions policies, but to pretend that a test that is basically measuring your scholastic ability is including measures that have nothing to do with scholastic ability is fraudulent. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's no longer a transparent indicator of what it says it's doing.
Right. Let's jump back across the continent now, back to California, and then we're going to jump back to Florida after that. But back to California in a moment. Governor Newsom signed a law recently having to do with charter schools. And it seems very benign when you look at it. It calls for greater transparency in charter schools. But if you follow education closely in California, this is significant for two reasons. Number one, this is a bill that Governor Brown, Jerry Brown, Gavin Newsom's predecessor, stayed away from purposely. He didn't want to go down this road with charter schools. And secondly, it does raise the question of Newsom, who was financed early by CTA, just as the new state superintendent is also underwritten by CTA, as are most lawmakers. They want to go after charter schools in various ways. And so the thought, the presumption is that if it's not a war on charter schools in California, it's perhaps the beginning of like a boa constrictor, just a slow strangulation.
Well, you know, California is interesting because it has some of the best charter schools in the United States. Mm-hmm. If the California school system, taken as a whole, looks rather sad if you compare it to Texas, for yeah. example, mm-hmm. I don't care what your ethnic or racial background is. On average, you're doing less well in California than you would be doing if you were on average in Texas. So somehow the Texas school system is outperforming the California system by more than just a little bit. Now, the opposite is true when it comes to charter schools. I mean, the Texas schools, charter schools are nothing to brag about particularly, but the California ones are really good. Mm-hmm. Now, what's happening is, of course, that in Los Angeles, where the charter schools have really established a very fine record, parents are flocking to the charter schools. Right. They are flooded. And meanwhile, the school district itself is losing enrollment. It's losing enrollment not only to the charter schools, it's also losing it to the suburban communities surrounding it and people not willing to live in Los Angeles because the schools are bad. And there's other school districts inside Los Angeles that people flock to. So people are choosing to get out of the Los Angeles school system any way they can. And charters are getting blamed for this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, therefore, it's an easy thing to go and tell parents in the public schools, oh, the charter schools are taking our money away from us. They may be fine schools, but they're taking away our money from us. Well, what do you mean they're taking your money away? The money should go follow the kids. All the money is doing is following the child. Wherever the child is, that's where the money goes. But that's not the slogan that is being used in campaigns against charter schools. And so, unfortunately, the charter schools are on the defensive all around the country, not only in California.
They seem to be. So you see the future as well for California, a cap on charter schools?
I don't know enough about California politics, mm-hmm. To be sure. My guess is that the charter school population, they have a constituency now. They have parents. They can put up a little more defense than they could have 10 years ago when mm-hmm. they were smaller. So they're a little bit bigger now. And right. any interest group that of any size can lobby on its own behalf. So I would think it's more likely that you're going to get regulation than anything else. And regulation can strangle you. It's entirely possible.
My advice to them would be to study the CTA and follow what CTA does. I can map out a future where the Teachers Association, Democratic lawmakers in Sacramento, they're going to just wait until a charter school does something wrong. And then they will pounce on it. They'll make that charter school the poster child for bad charter schools across California and use that as a pretext for invasion, if you will. But we've been spending a lot of time criticizing public education, Paul. Let's talk about a place where it's working, and that's Miami. Now, you mentioned that you recently had an opportunity to hear what's going on in Miami and what's working.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The Miami school district is larger than the usual school district. Mm-hmm. But so is Los Angeles. Right. At Dade County in Miami, it's called the Dade County School District, is the third largest school district in the country.
It's obviously very diverse between white, African-American, and Latino.
Yeah, there's only a small percentage of white students in the Miami Dade County School District. I think it's like 80% African-American or Hispanic. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's got a substantial Cuban population, which right. is a very unusual Hispanic migration, much better educated than most Hispanic migrations. It was a political migration. People were fleeing Castro, and a lot of the talent of that middle-class Cuban migration went into the schools right. as school teachers. So you've got a lot of resources within the Hispanic community that mm-hmm. are being devoted to the educational system. Right. But they also have a leader who's been there for 10 years, and one of the things in education that is a real problem is that in big city school systems, superintendents tend to come and go. They're there for about 2-3 years. Right. They have some nostrum that's going to fix things up, and then pretty soon they're gone and another one comes in with another solution. That's not the case in Miami. They've had a superintendent there for a 10-year period of time. New York City tried to get him to come to New York. He almost right. went, but the people in Miami said, please, please don't go, and they must have upped his pay a bit because he stayed and he's there for the long run.
So who is he? And
so
what,
so he's
who
a, is he a and real what, leader, right. but he's also introduced a lot of school choice within mm-hmm. to the system.
Right.
He's got a lot of charter schools, and he's fighting off the charter schools, and he's right. fighting off the migration to the suburbs. He's facing all the issues at Los Angeles. Right. But so how does he fight back? He says, I'm going to give you choice inside the Miami school right. system. And the end result is his enrollment is growing, mm-hmm. and his test scores are going up. And so right. if you look at Florida's got one of the best records across the country, and within Florida, Miami's doing the best. So it's a little bit of an unusually capable leader bringing in a complete new administrative staff.
Right.
He fired all the bad apples and brought in his own team, and he's spends a lot of attention to detail and then gives the system – creates a lot of choice within the system. So it's a fascinating story.
So what is his name, and is it as simple as saying that choice is the answer? Tell me his name first.
Now you always put me on the spot when you ask me for a name. Carvalho.
Carvalho.
Alberto Carvalho.
Okay.
So he is a person who can speak to the Hispanic community fluently, and at the same time, he's able to he was going to become he started teaching in physics. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of the kind of education he had. He was an immigrant into Miami, a Republican member of Congress met him and took him under his wing and made sure he got to college, where he majored in physics. And he went into teaching physics and rose through the ranks. And, very unbelievably unbelievable path, a spectacular path. Right. And it takes it's the kind of a leader that you can't count on emerging anywhere and everywhere.
But is there more to the story than just saying he introduced choice in ways that Los Angeles and other cities across America have not?
He had a lot of help from the state legislature because there was a lot of push in the state legislature for creating choice outside the system, putting a lot of pressure inside the system. The teachers' union is much weaker in Florida than it is in California. So he had a way of putting resources together that are not so easily done in California. Mm. But also, he had a very strong administrative structure. And so, but he was able to, and then when he arrived, the Miami school system was in financial difficulties. It almost went under. And he took some strong steps by firing people, not on the grounds that they were ineffective, but on the grounds that we have to cut in order to balance our budget. Mm-hmm. So he applied the principle that, if you you should never let a financial crisis not be a moment of opportunity.
Right.
So he turns it into a moment of opportunity. He gets rid of the bad apples, and he's able to start over again. And once he turns that system around, he's got his school board behind him. He's got the community behind him. And he's now an incredibly popular leader. And the school system is thriving, actually.
Final question, because we're running up against a deadline here. You do polling on education.
Yes.
And you're putting a poll out in the field soon?
Oh, we already have the results in. So, okay. But we haven't released them
yet.
We're
doing results,
the analysis right now.
You can't tell me the results, but what were you looking at in the poll?
Well, we looked at how much do people like school choice. Is that going up or down? Has Trump improved things or not? And we're going to have some surprising findings for you on that. We're looking at do people want to spend more on education, even when they know how much is currently being spent? Mm-hmm. We're going to have some surprising findings on that. So there's a lot of meat in there, but I can't tell you the exact details at this point.
That's a good tease to keep us tuned in. The 4th of July is coming up in a couple of days. So let's put this in a freedom context. Final question. How free – we measure freedom in a lot of ways in America, a lot of First Amendment rights and so forth. But you, Paul, look at freedom and education. How free are students and parents these days?
Well, you know, one of the things we do in this poll is we ask parents and students questions about schooling, and usually they give pretty much the same answer, like mother, like daughter.
Yeah.
It used to be like father, like son, but it's equally true, like mother, like daughter. But once in a while, you find a difference, and we're finding out that the students are less happy with their local school than their parents are.
Hmm.
Now, these are high school kids. But I think this is telling us something. This is telling us something about high schools are not satisfying their clientele. There's something wrong with our high schools. Mm-hmm. And if I were to say there's any one thing we need to do that we haven't been doing is to pay more attention to the problem that the high school presents for young people today. If we could refix, if we could find a solution to the high school, we might turn our educational system around.
It's interesting. Are they unhappy about the culture of the high school? Are they unhappy about the curriculum? Are they unhappy about the teacher?
I think it's all of those things. Right. You know, we don't pay our high school teachers more than our elementary school teachers. Yet a high school teacher is supposed to know physics and chemistry.
Right.
And the teachers are not knowledgeable about their subject matter. I think it's also because the peer group culture is toxic in a school system. We need to create much more specialized institutions so young people can be engaged in activities that are really of great interest to them. And and interests start to diverge at that point in time. So we need to give a lot more choice, not just in the sense of alternative places to go, but real different kinds of places to go.
I think there are a lot of roads to go down here. I think there's a conversation about the culture within a school. Kids feel comfortable, or kids feeling bullied, or kids, you know, happy with their own identity. There's a relationship with the teacher, and I think the teacher's happiness within the system, too, because if you have an unhappy teacher, you can pick that up in the vibe. I remember a million years ago when I was in high school, and we had very happy teachers and very grumpy teachers, and the grumpy teachers were just not fun to be around.
If you have to go through a metal detector to get to school, there's something wrong.
There is that. And then I think it's also a question of the curriculum as well. Not to make this too political, but if you're a young kid and maybe you're a little right of center, you know, do you get anything in the classroom that maybe you want to hear in terms of your beliefs, or are you getting a lot of negative anti-conservatism thrown at you? And maybe that's more of a college problem than a high school problem, but this is just, I think, a multifaceted problem facing our country right now.
I think sometimes preaching is a substitute for teaching in schools.
Good rhyme. Well, let's cut it off with that. Paul Peterson, a happy 4th of July. I'm glad your family is out here safe and sound. When are you headed back east?
Well, we're going to be headed east in about 2 weeks, and we're headed to Africa shortly after that.
Wow. Well, safe travels, my friend. Thanks for doing the podcast. Let's do it again when the poll comes out.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the conversation, Paul. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. Tell your friends about us. Have them get a listen. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows, including Paul Peterson, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. I reference Paul's work with Education Next. Education Next is located on the internet at educationnext.org. And you can find it on Twitter as well. Its Twitter handle is @EducationNext. That's EducationNext at Education Next. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. As always, thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.